Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass, and we have a very special episode for you today. Delighted to be joined by Scott Gatzmeier. He is the corporate vice president of U.S. expansion for Micron, the leading semiconductor company. Scott, how are you?
Hey, doing well, Oren. Thank you so much for having me on your program, and thanks for all the work you've done to advocate for the onshoring of U.S. semiconductors. It's great to be with you today.
Well, thank you for, in fact, onshoring U.S. semiconductors, which I think is probably a lot harder than advocating for it. That's exactly what we want to talk about. So,
yeah, no, really excited about these projects.
Yeah, tell us just a little bit about yourself, your role, and sort of how Micron fits into the industry for folks who spend their days legislating.
Yeah. So I work for Micron Technology, and I've been with Micron Technology for around 27 years, actually. I was an intern here in 1997, wow, if you can believe that. And so I've done a lot of different roles inside of the company, started out in an electrical test, moved to the fab, and then actually went down to Utah to help start the Intel Micron joint venture, and then came back to work in R&D about 8-9 years ago now. And then the last 2.5 years, I've been working on the U.S. expansion, including the site selection where we selected Boise, Idaho for one fab expansion that will be co-located with our research and development facilities at our headquarters here. And then our mega fab in right by Syracuse, New York, in Clay, New York, that we're really excited about.
Terrific. And for folks who just hear the word semiconductor and know that's just a chip, you know, how does Micron fit in? How should folks think about Micron compared to Intel or a TSMC and so forth?
Yeah. So at Micron, we make memory and storage. Memory you can think of as DRAM, which is dynamic random access memory. And that's really the memory that sits right next to the CPU, and it's in everything, right? So anywhere there would be a processor from Intel, AMD, there's got to be memory to be able to provide the data so that that processor can work. And then the storage, we make NAND flash memory, which is in all of your SSDs, all of your flash cards, it's in your phones, it's everywhere as well. So that's what Micron makes, and we're the only U.S. supplier of memory and storage.
And in terms of sort of thinking about the technological challenges, or, you know, the cutting edge, or this many nanometers, that many, is it fair to say, you know, memory chips aren't at the kind of smallest, highest tech scale, but when it comes to memory, what you guys are doing is at the leading edge? Is that sort of the right way to think about it?
I think that we're at the leading edge across the board, if you think about it that way. The feature size that's measured in a logic chip versus a memory chip is different because it's a different type of transistor that's measured. But, you know, on our next generation of DRAM, we still require EUV memory to be able to produce it. And at Micron here, we're the technology leader in both DRAM and NAND flash. So on DRAM, you know, we took the lead with our 1-alpha nanometer technology, and we'll be extending it with the release of our 1-beta. And then the 1-gamma, which would be the next generation after that, would be the node that we'll be mass producing in Boise, Idaho, and then Syracuse, New York after that.
Awesome. So that's what we're making. Where do you make it now? And what is sort of driven the development of the footprint over time?
Yeah. So if you look at the memory industry over time, you know, back in 1975, 90% of the world's DRAM was made here in the U.S. And then it really kind of started with Japan first, wanting to build DRAM and enter the memory market. And they used, you know, low loans, some incentives to be able to do that and get in the industry and rise. And after that, South Korea kind of said, hey, we want to do everything that Japan's doing, and really worked on growing their memory market. And then Taiwan went after the memory market as well and offered substantial incentives to be able to introduce this. And, you know, the memory market historically has been fairly cyclical. You know, there'll be lots of demand, and then we'll go through kind of peaks and valleys of that. And there were a lot of players in the industry, and it used to be more cyclical because of the number of players. Well, at Micron, we've really consolidated the industry by acquiring assets in Japan and in Taiwan, and through those acquisitions, that's where we have a lot of our manufacturing capability. In fact, all but about 8% of our DRAM is manufactured in those two locations. And then we have a facility in Manassas, Virginia, where we manufacture a lot of our automotive and other DRAM at that facility.
And so as you're thinking about talking about the next ones that are going to come online, what do the economics of it actually look like at this point? If you're sitting around headquarters, you're kind of making the business case for where do we put our next plant? Well, yeah, I don't know. Let's do it as a kind of divide up the pie.
Yeah.
How much comes down to sort of geography, incentives, talent base? How does that equation work?
So, you know, first you've got the U.S. versus Asia question, right? If you look at building a semiconductor fab, it's about 40% more expensive to build it for construction cost here in the U.S. versus Asia.
So and you that's have to before thinking about any incentives either
that's
way.
That's before thinking about incentives either way, right? And then the equipment that you put in, which makes up, you know, a large percentage, probably the largest single percentage of the cost of a fab, would be the same cost whether you put it here or in Asia. Right? Because you're going to pay ASML, Applied Materials, the same price for a tool, no matter where it lands. And then the other part where the U.S. is disadvantaged would be in labor costs, right? You know, so our employees who would be working in the fab and that labor cost. However, where the U.S. does have advantages is in utilities, right? So power costs in the U.S. are lower by a substantial amount. If you look at access to water, you know, those types of things, the U.S. is advantaged. And that kind of offsets the labor. And then when you look at now the CHIPS and ITC Act, so the, you know, FABS Act, which is the investment tax credit, 25% of qualified semiconductor spend, that helps offset that 40%, you know, cost differential. And then the CHIPS grants will help offset that. So that enables you really to build in the U.S. cost competitively. So now you've got that problem solved. Now you've got to look across the country and led the site selection. And we chose, you know, two locations, as I mentioned earlier, Boise, Idaho and Clay, New York. So first Boise, Idaho, building one fab here. When you look at what we have, building that fab adjacent to our research and development fab will help us with some intangibles, right? And some tangible value with equipment sharing, which will be fantastic, but also faster cycle time, faster qualifications, faster ramp of getting product out to our customers. Provides us some intangible benefits that really we get from building one mega fab here in Boise, Idaho. Then when you look at the large scale, you know, four fab, 2.4 million square feet that we're building in New York, first you had to find, you know, a plot of land that could fit that size, right? Contiguous. And so we looked, you know, went to 11 states, 18 different sites looking at that. And so you find that good flat piece of ground that you can build on. Next, you look at the utilities. Reliable power is incredibly important. If you have a disruption in power at your facility, you know, it can take you down for weeks and be tens of millions of dollars worth of lost product, even for, you know, a few phases of cycles of power loss. So that site has a 345 kV substation that has a power plant about 40 miles away, and it was one of the most reliable substations in the U.S. that we looked at. Next, you look at the availability of water and why we're aiming towards 100%, you know, water conservation through reuse, recycling, and those aspects. There's still going to be a lot of water evaporation, a lot of water use that you're going to have to have going through there. And so the access to Lake Ontario, again, 40 miles away, was another unbelievable resource that we'd have there. And then the state of New York has a long track record in a large university pool with semiconductors. You know, IBM was there, you know, it's still there, but there in a big way. You look at Cornell, Clarkson, Syracuse, you know, they're going to increase their engineering programs. RIT, you know, just the number of great universities, the whole SUNY network system and semiconductor programs that we'd be able to tie into. And then Albany Nanotech Center, that's there as well. And being able to tie into that with some of our partners, you know, for potentially future R&D and other things like that was very exciting about the region.
I see. So that gives a good sense of sort of all of the lines in the spreadsheet almost as you're kind of choosing between these things. curious to dig a little bit more on that sort of upfront construction cost difference. What makes it so much more expensive to build here?
Yeah, I think, you know, semiconductor projects are the most advanced, you know, these fabs are the most advanced construction projects that you can do. And I sat through a keynote with Exide at ISS Semi last year, and it was interesting listening to them on a per hour basis. They're the most expensive projects to build as well, because you're always trying to, you know, productize it and get these things built as fast as you can. So if you look at the number of skilled labor that we need to bring in to do like clean room pipe fitting, the electrical requirements that are out there for all these tool connections, and again, at clean room requirements. So all of it has to be done in that manner. It's incredibly expensive to be able to get that skilled labor to come in, and that labor is more expensive here than in the other parts of the U.S. The other thing that I think you're going to see with the amount of fabs that have been announced here in the U.S. is the demand for that labor is going to be tremendous. And so that's going to drive up. And that's one of the reasons why we did project labor agreements in both Idaho and New York. When you look at the unions and the amount of travelers that we're going to need to bring in for these projects, there's just not the construction workforce directly located where any of these fabs have been announced. So being able to bring in travelers, be able to bring in people, and then also continue to trade in the union halls and partner with them, you know, for the specific high purity welding that we're going to require, other things like that, and get those skills incorporated so that more people can take advantage of this, you know, semiconductor renaissance that's going to be done here in the U.S. and take advantage of these high paying jobs that are going to go on. I mean, if you look at the construction at Clay, we're going to be building there for 20 years, right? So people can have a career and have, you know, a key location where they're doing that construction and not seasonal type work, which was a lot of construction folks do today. So we're really trying to take a holistic approach to that, not only, you know, our team members, but also the team members, you know, who will be doing the construction of these projects.
That's the unit piece is interesting. It's just sort of American Compass kind of synergies. This is another area we work a lot on is labor policy and the question of kind of, you know, what are the drawbacks of unions as they operate today versus what are the real strengths and advantages they can bring? I'm curious about your experience with that. What has that been like at Micron, worked through PLAs before? What sort of surprised you about it?
Yeah, no, Micron had not worked through PLAs before. And most of my construction experience is here in Boise, Idaho and Utah as well. And here we'll have union and non-union, you know, shops work side by side with no PLA in place. You know, they're open bid. You know, they're able to come in and do that. And that's kind of how we've always worked. And so New York is where we did the first PLA and going through and doing that. And this will allow us to, you know, work with the unions, but then also have non-union come in on the job and really control effectively being able to get enough labor, right? Control the working conditions, allow those things to happen and allow the unions to be a part of this large scale project, which we'll absolutely need them. You know, we'll need every construction worker in the company, in the country to come be a part of these projects as we grow.
And has that, you know, one criticism of the CHIPS Act already, or, you know, complaint from some folks trying this kind of development has been an inability to find the skilled labor that they need. Has your experience been also an inability to find it, or has the PLA sort of helped to solve that problem?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in New York, we're still doing environmental permitting. So I think the PLA, we're engaging it and we're starting early engagement there to build this up. And we're working, you know, with like Syracuse Builds to how do we train more people to be ready and starting well in advance of when we need that workforce, because we absolutely see some of the issues that others have had. And then in Idaho, we view this is going to help us to bring in the workforce that we need to be able to go do it. And so far, we've been successful.
Interesting. But permitting, which is exactly the next thing I was going to ask you about. That's another pain point for some. What has your experience been there? Is it sort of as expected of the cost of doing business, things you're learning from one that apply to the next?
Yeah. You know, throughout this process, we knew that we'd be having to go through the NEPA and then in New York, also the CECRA, the state environmental project. So we knew what we'd be doing. And in Idaho, we've got a long track record of partnership here and going through and do that. I don't want to say that it's been easy. I mean, this is a lot of studies, a lot of work, but it's also something that we want to do in the right way. We're committed to sustainability, committed to the environment. You know, we live in the same communities where we work, and we want to make sure that these are lively communities. Both communities have great outdoor recreation activities and that stuff. So we absolutely want to preserve it and build these fabs in the right way. So I would say we knew it. In Idaho, things have progressed to plan and we've been working through it. In New York, we did a lot of due diligence on the land there in advance. In Oceida, which is the Onondaga community, they were very transparent with, you know, what was going on with the site. So I wouldn't say that we've had any surprises and we're working through this path, but it is a substantial amount of diligence. You know, when you look at wetland studies, when you look at all the traffic studies, when you look at everything going on that way, air permitting, all those types of things. And so actually, you know, building these things here in the US is doing it the right way, if you look at that.
Does it play significantly into the cost? I mean, time is money in a sense, but to what extent it just mean the timeline looks different, or as you're comparing to what we'd mean to build one of these plants potentially much more cheaply in Asia?
Yeah.
Is the permitting and just, I guess, the process and what it therefore requires to be in project and a big piece of it?
I think when you look at the cost of the studies and everything that you do, that cost, I would say, is compared to the overall cost of the factory, fairly insignificant, right? It wouldn't, you know, drive your decision one way or the other. I think you do have to be more thoughtful in your preparation, knowing that you have to go through these studies and how quickly you could get to groundbreaking, right? Or how quickly you could move on it versus other areas. But, you know, Japan, very committed to the environment. Micron, we're committed to sustainable operations wherever we go. Taiwan has rigorous standards as well. So does Singapore. I mean, in Singapore, you're operating right next to a very large, you know, metropolitan
state. There's not a lot of extra space to spray.
No. So, you know, we've got to do these things wherever we are, and we're committed to doing wherever we are. So I wouldn't say that there's a significant cost, like the abatement systems that we'll put in. You know, we're putting in a house abatement system in these fabs, state of the art, to have the higher DRE, destruction or removal efficiency rate of, you know, potential air contaminants. We do that everywhere we operate. So really try to be good corporate citizens, regardless of the geo.
Yeah. And so you're not the permitting is a process to move through, but you're not having to build the plant in a different and more expensive way than you would for us.
Exactly.
Yes. All right. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the sort of broader economic impact. Obviously, it's sort of people expect it to be positive. When you think about sort of the ecosystem that one of these plants is operating in, what is the scale of the partnerships, you know, on the supplier side, the customer side? Give a sense of what that looks like for a place where these.
Yeah. So I'll start with Boise and then talk about New York, just so you can see how these things scale. So in Boise, we're going to hire 2,000 Micron team members to come be a part of this fab. And so we'll hire technicians, we'll hire engineers predominantly, but there'll be also finance jobs, you know, HR jobs and other jobs like that as well. But the bulk of those 2,000 jobs are going to be technicians and engineers. So technicians to operate and maintain all of our equipment that's in the fab, and then engineers to develop the processes and improve yields and do those items. So 2,000 Micron jobs. If you look at it, right now, there's going to be over 15,000 community jobs that are created as a result of that. So if you think about long-term construction jobs that are going to be here on the site, those jobs will be created. Also, you know, all of our supplier partners, so Applied Materials, Lam, Tel, KLA, all of them are going to have field service engineers and going to have to substantially increase the amount of team members that they have in Boise, Idaho to support this manufacturing project. Then you look at, you know, all of the Air Liquide or Air Gas or whoever we have come in to do that gas plant, they're going to have employees. If you look at a lot of the machine shops around the valley, you know, they're going to have employees who build gas boxes for us and scale up. And then the great thing about, you know, the semiconductor industry and why these jobs are so coveted, you know, really around the globe is they bring revenue in. It's not like, you know, a dentist office or a doctor's office where it's a service industry and just changing dollars in the community, but they're going to, these jobs and these people who are going to come here are going to drive more dentist office, more restaurants, more hotels, more service industry. And so that's how you build up to the 15,000 jobs and the economic growth that's really going to come here. And so throughout this project, you know, Micron's going to directly infuse $15.3 billion into the Idaho economy, and $13 billion will be spent with Idaho businesses here once you get down to it. So tremendous economic engine, if you will. Then you take that to New York, you know, over the 20 years, our investment is going to create over 9,000 Micron jobs. And the conservative estimate that we have for New York is over 50,000 community jobs there. And you're going to see all these same things just amplified because of the scale that's going to be go there. And because, you know, all of our direct suppliers don't have offices there. So they're going to have to set up, establish from scratch. And so, you know, when you look at what type of economic development these types of facilities do, they build cities almost in a way right around them. And these are good, high paying jobs that can really transform a community when you look at it that way.
Yeah, the point about the sort of revenue generating, I think is super important and something we always try to emphasize in, you know, it's fine to be a service-based economy and it's great to have a job, you know, the restaurant jobs and the dentist office jobs. But at the end of the day, your community does need to be making something for the rest of the world because you need a lot of stuff from the rest of the world too. And so having that anchor producer is vital. Is there a sort of broader ecosystem phenomenon that you've seen? It can certainly tell you that the policy wonks hypothesize that, you know, where Micron is doing this, now that you bring in the engineers, you bring in the R&D, you bring in the suppliers, well, now someone else is going to set up, you know, or start their semiconductor company. Is that something you've seen in Boise in particular?
Yeah. I mean, so in Idaho, if you look at the number of smaller satellite companies that have come up around us, there've been quite a few. Are, you know, people leave Micron and go do a startup or other things like that. You see it. And then you see the benefit of like an RM Mechanical that's here. That's a machine shop that does a lot of work for us in high purity gas boxes, other things like that. You see a lot of those types of manufacturers and businesses start up and drive. And then this is just going to take it to a much larger scale. And then we're obviously working, you could say it's a little bit, if you build it, they will come, right? If you build the large scale fabs, then the supply chain's going to come with it because they'll view this as a business opportunity. And so we're working with all of our, you know, downstream suppliers to talk to them about how do they set up here in the U.S.? Because if you look at the amount of water that's in some of the chemicals or, you know, that are shipped, like these would be no fly because of the weight or because of whatever it is, they've got to be shipped on tankers overseas. And then they have a shelf life per se. So if they were actually manufactured here in the U.S. as well, it would be a much more secure supply chain. And I think through COVID, we all saw, you know, the challenges with supply chain. So getting them to come here will be good. And that'll be another amplification effect of, you know, having semiconductors built right here in the U.S.
I understand. So I want to think about the bigger CHIPS Act picture for a minute. And I've been fascinated by some of the kind of initial discourse around it, really since its passage, where, you know, within a year and a half, people immediately start saying, you're like, huh, this isn't working. The U.S. isn't yet the leading semiconductor producer, or, you know, 2 years in, why hasn't the money all been spent? Or, TSMC still says their AI, 90% of AI chips will be made, here or there. On one hand, this is sort of facially ludicrous. This is obviously a program whose success will be evaluated 10, 20 years down the line. On the other hand, it is fair to say, you have to be able to show something sooner than that. You don't get to just say, come talk to us in 20 years. How would you recommend people kind of assess progress as this goes along? What's a fair set of things to be looking at after a couple of years? What should people be committing to? Look, within 5 years, we will be able to see X or Y that tells us if it's working or not.
Yeah, I think, very insightful question. And if you look at the, movement of mass production of semiconductors from the US to Asia, it's been going on for the last 4 decades or 5 decades even, right? That transition. So it's not going to be shifted overnight. And when you look at these facilities, we're talking multi-tens of billions of dollars of investment in these facilities, the most complex and most advanced manufacturing on the planet. They're not going to be built overnight, right? So I would say I really want to congratulate, Secretary Raimondo and her team on the announcements that they've done today, right? In the grants that they've dispersed. And I think they've built a very strong team. We're working with them closely. We're still negotiating, so I can't go into detail on that. But there's a lot of industry experts on the team, a lot of financial experts that they've brought. So it's a very strong team, and I can commend them on their tenacity and their drive and what they're working to accomplish. I think in the short term, if you look at the number of fabs and the number of projects that have been announced in the US since the passage of the CHIPS and Fabs Act, that would be, how I would judge number one, because I don't think you would see nowhere near the amount of investment. I can say Micron would not have announced our projects had those bills not passed, because of the economics that I mentioned earlier. So if you look at that in the resurgence there, that's a key win. If you look at the amount of investment that's going on in universities, like at Micron, we've established the Northeast University Network and the Northwest University Network to help bolster traditional pathways to build, this, that's absolutely a huge thing. We're also looking for non-traditional pathways with apprenticeships through community colleges. We invested $5 million in the Onondaga Community College clean room. We're partnering with different military bases to really help veterans transition out to take advantage of the semiconductor industry resurgence. So if you look at the opportunities that are being created in the workforce and doing that development pipeline and encouraging people to go into STEM activities, because there's going to be a promise at the end of the day for them to have a long filled career, that's absolutely going to be huge. I think in 5 years, you need to start seeing those first fabs come online. So, here in even shorter than that. So here in our Boise fab, you're going to see, our first tools will start rolling in towards the end of 2025. And then first wafers out will be in 2026. And then we'll ramp that fab throughout the end of the decade. And that'll be on the most advanced DRAM technology anywhere. So you're getting that advanced manufacturing state-of-the-art technology. Then our New York fab trails that by about 18 months to 2 years, and then we'll continue to ramp that. So you'll start seeing these fabs come on, and I think that'll be big. So before the end of the decade, there will be multiple fabs, starting to produce wafers out that we would not have seen otherwise. And then how do we continue, to build on this momentum throughout, the next decade, 2030, I think will be a big part, because the world has recognized the economic importance in the national, which we've talked about what it does for communities, but also the national security importance. It's not just the US that has, these incentives. Japan has incentives. Europe has their own CHIPS Act. South Korea now has done this. The list goes on. So how's the US going to continue to be competitive long term would be the other thing that I would like, them to continue to think about for this industry.
Yeah. Perfect segue to the last question. So thank you. The question about momentum and sort of what comes next, I think is always key. And there's almost two elements. One is just, what else do we need right now? I mean, what, you know, as someone who's actively trying to get this stuff going, or is there a particular roadblock, a particular thing you've seen in another country that you say like, oh gosh, you know, here's a tweak or a regulation or an amendment that would really make a difference? Well, let's start there, and then I'll add the second part at the end.
I think, I mean, if you were to ask me a little bit of the same question, what keeps me up at night, or, you know, getting the workforce for these fabs and building the workforce of the future, I think is going to be a real challenge. And so that comes multifold. So first, you know, we need to build a diverse workforce of the future, and we need to get more people in to this STEM workforce across the board. So that's why I talk about, you know, traditional pathways and then also the non-traditional pathways. How do we reach out and get more people coming in? So at Micron, you know, like, we're building a daycare right across the street from our headquarters. My wife was an engineer for Micron, you know, and she quit when we had our daughter. Had there been a daycare across the street, would she still be in, you know, the technology center doing this? Maybe. And so we've already purchased the land in New York to do that. We're reaching out to a lot of the universities, you know, HBCUs, Hispanic serving institutions, trying to partner with them, getting more people into this workforce, and how do we continue to increase it? The other thing, if you look at, you know, legal immigration and the number of visas, and how do we bring this expertise, right, from some of our other Micron facilities here and support them and bring them in, would be another area that we've got to work on, right, having that be streamlined, because there is expertise that is not here that we need to have brought here to help bring these facilities online. So looking at the workforce holistically and really driving that, I think, is very important. Just, it's the right thing to do. And then also, we really need to do it because we're going to need more people if we're going to make all of these semiconductor fabs a realization. So that's a little bit more near term. And then longer term, it would be, okay, you know, chips one passed, but now what are we going to do for future legislation? What does that look like? And how do we build on this momentum that we have?
Yeah. And that was exactly what I wanted to end with, was thinking beyond chips one. I mean, I suppose there's one world in which it's just, well, we will need more money for the next set of fabs, right? And to some degree, hopefully the momentum for chips one makes it so you don't need as much public money in the future. If every other country is still offering it, presumably we will need to as well. Are there other sort of investments? I mean, I guess this goes to the workforce point as well. In the much bigger picture, things the United States needs to be on top of in 2030. That policymakers should think about now.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the workforce and how do policymakers invest in that and really encourage more people going into STEM fields, whatever they are, to build that workforce and be competitive at making things, you know, like you said, beyond semiconductors. Then if you look at it, I think a lot of the natural resources that we use, and how do we ensure that those natural resources continue to be here, you know, from several of the elements, other things like that that we use, safe mining practices, other things like that. How do we open up, you know, with sustainability in mind and doing those types of items to ensure that the U.S. is successful in opening that up? You know, our overall infrastructure, I talked earlier about the importance of, you know, power and water. How do we ensure that we continue to have low cost power and have the advantages that we can realize and continue that as we move forward?
Terrific. Well, this has been fantastic. As I was saying before we jumped on, I would have wanted to do this conversation just to talk with you offline, but I really appreciate your willingness to do it this way so we can share with a lot of folks who I know are deeply, deeply interested in the issue. And most of us certainly don't do it for a living. And so, you know, as I said, the advocating is the easy part. Actually, onshoring our semiconductors is the hard part. So thank you for everything you're doing. And thank you again for joining us today.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all your advocacy for our industry. And thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.